Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 397 of the Roguecast, recorded November 13th, 2022, Texas Arctic Winter Day. All right, it's just me and Dave this time. Nick's fandom of Deadpool got to be too much and we murdered him.
Nick is currently walking off like the sad ending of the old Hulk TV show. He's with like a little pack. He's got a backpack on. He's hitchhiking and he's sad. And yes. The sad music is playing.
Yes.
No, with him. Nick is actually off. He had a few days off to enjoy.
He did, and
he miscalculated, and he's like and off got, one day longer.
And he got an extra day off to enjoy because he miscalculated. So yes, he is currently driving back while we podcast without him.
Yep, that means we get to make fun of him.
Yep, and he told us we could say that we murdered him because of his love of Deadpool.
Yep, so
I did.
That's a factual thing now.
Next week he'll be resurrected.
Yes,
because of his love for Deadpool. A man who loves Deadpool can never be truly killed.
He's redeemed in this time, this year of this season of resurrection.
These are the footprints of when Deadpool was carrying.
That's when Deadpool was actually skipping with you. Clearly, he was skipping. Here's the one where he tripped and dropped you. There's a big butt print on the ground. That was him just doing that for laughs.
Here's the one where Deadpool accidentally shot you in the face like Marvel in Pulp Fiction.
Right, that's why there's blood all over this beach now. All right, that's enough screen time for Deadpool. Let's move on.
All right. So it should be a lighter podcast. There's not a ton of stuff this week, but there are a couple notable things.
Yeah. Solid week of new comics. We've got, I think, some new games to mention.
So yeah, last week was a huge week for new games. I guess everybody decided let's get one last shot in before Christmas.
Yep.
And right about end of the week, we got like 25 new games.
Mm-hmm.
Among the things we got from Foambrain Games, we got the new, Blind Bags from them, the Winter Village is their Christmas theme.
These are all
ones.
Dice things.
Yes. Yeah. Well, sort of. This one, I think they all.
Foambrain is mostly known for dice or pin sets and those little mystery dice sets.
So this is their mystery dice for Christmas this year. It has a wintry themed D20 and a pins that can also be used as ornaments on your tree.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Which is pretty cool. And they're all like monsters in snowy outfits and that kind of thing.
Yeah. In other words, perfect stocking stuffers.
Yep, perfect stocking stuffers. You get a blind bag, you get a dice, and you get a pin, you don't know what you're going
to
get.
I don't think we need to promote these at all, Randy. They do amazingly well.
I think they do. But I would like to let people know.
No.
The other thing we got...
They'll find out.
This was a Kickstarter that we got from them. It's the Lost Tome of Monsters. It is their new... So basically, it comes with a D20... A pin that you can wear, but then also you can flip the little.
It's like a little monster pin, like a little troll or a monster, and yeah, the Tome of Monster image that's at the bottom of the pin flips down to become the base of the pin.
It becomes a miniature.
Yeah, and you can actually like put this miniature on there, and there's like a card with like a little scenario,
and there's a card with an encounter for that monster in the thing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
There's like 25 different monsters.
Yep, super fun. I was also like, especially I think if I was like, I think it'd be good for just about anybody, but if I was a kid, I would love getting the little scenario cards and throwing these guys into a mix in the game.
We also, in addition to the blind bags of those, there are three standalones you can buy. There's a Black Dragon, which is a Kickstarter exclusive. Once that one's gone, it's gone. And basically then you know you're getting the Black Dragon pin, you're getting a die, which has a Black Dragon on the D20, and you're getting the monster card with it. There's the Gelatinous Cube. Pin, and then there is the one that's the most expensive of the three of them. It's got three treasure chests in them. Two of them open and they have treasure. The other one opens and it's a mimic.
Oh, that's so good.
And there's an encounter that goes with it and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Mimics are the best.
Mimics are great. That's what a mimic would say, Dave.
That's true. But do I look... I'm not a treasure chest.
That's fair. Mimics can be anything now.
I mean, yeah, that's true.
Mimics are self-actualized. They can be anything they want.
Look them up in the Monster Manual. It'll be like, a mimic can turn into a chest, or a table, or a Dave.
Or a Dave. we also got, from Foambrain, some new metal dice. The Meteor style, which are like these sharp, they have these sharp points on them.
Oh, yeah, they look cool.
The Brigandine, which are pretty cool, and the Dragonstone ones. They're all sort of shinier. I really liked all these new sets.
Yeah. Yep.
So come check out our metal sets. Again, perfect Christmas present.
Yep. And they've been refreshed for the holidays.
And then we got the new D&D line of minis, which contained... They decided to get weird with it, because this one has the Vegapygmies.
Oh, right, right. You're talking about these are the unpainted WizKids ones.
Yes,
not
minis,
like
yes.
Not like one of the pre-paint minis.
No, no.
Yes, it was a weird line.
Adventure Pygmies, yep. Murder Hornets.
Murder Hornets.
Enlarged Dwergar, which sounds more suggestive than it should.
Yep. Do people know what Dwergar are?
Why don't you tell people the Dwergar, Dave?
I shall. Just as drow are dark elves, these are Dwergar are like dark dwarves. They're like the evil I guess all dwarves are underground dwarves, but they're the especially evil ones that are more evil than regular dwarves.
Not all dwarves are evil. All dwarves are underground, not all dwarves are evil.
If they're underground, I think there's clearly something off. but yes, the enlarged Dwergar, because dwarves kind of look like fire giants and stuff like that, yep. Or rather, fire giants look like big dwarves.
Sure.
The enlarged Dwergar does look like a small fire giant.
So, you know, this is the thing. The Dwergar can turn invisible at will, and they can grow at will. Like, they can become giant.
Okay,
they're all magical, yes.
I did not know that.
That is why Dwergar have that. That's their ability.
So it's the same way that, like, don't the drow have a few, like, little spells that they can do?
Spells, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So this is the Dwergar's thing.
Every Dwergar, when it's born, can grow. So Dwergar babies can, by mistake, I assume, grow to be Dwergar size and then go to work.
Boy, you want
to
hope that happens after the baby's been delivered.
Oh, yeah.
every Dwergar enlarges, but not every Dwergar truly lives. As the old saying goes.
Yes, yeah. Dave, remind me, what are the deep gnomes, the evil gnomes? What
are they? The Svervfnderblin. that one you're going to have to look up. Do type out, do Google deep gnomes, and I hope it'll come up with nothing too messed up. But yeah, they're the evil gnomes, and they gave them like some kind of Scandinavian name that nobody has ever been able to pronounce. But please send your pronunciation guess, your best guess, to our email. It's something like Svernerblerhern.
So when I looked up evil gnomes, by the way,
yeah.
What I get is garden gnomes, a variety of messed up garden gnomes. So when you look it up, I think you're going to want to add D&D.
Yeah, probably so.
Because that will get you... now they're called Erdlin. So this is the other thing. Oh, that's the chaotic gnome. This should be a thing. I can't easily find... Oh, there we go. Svirfnerblin.
Svirfnerblin?
Svirfnerblin.
Yeah. Obviously.
Yeah. Svirfnerblin.
Yeah, say the word.
Good Svirfnerblin to you, Dave.
And a Merry Snurflublin to you. Merry Snurflublin.
We also got the line of D&D Miniatures Paints, the official prismatic miniatures are from Vallejo.
Yeah, this is a nice-looking set, and it's not like a giant set. It's what, like... But it's like 60 of them or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. We've got the display right at the register, so you'll see it when you're ringing stuff up. You'll see it right when you walk in.
Yeah.
And they look cool. Vallejo, they're new enough that we haven't heard a ton of reports back, but I know Vallejo has a reputation in the industry.
Yep.
They've been around for, like, at least 10, 15 years and quite possibly longer than I know, and that, like, maybe it's, like, 20 or 30 or something. Who knows?
We've got the individual paints. We've got a couple of sets you can buy.
Yep.
So, yeah, if you're looking for paints, especially for a good Christmas gift.
Am I correct that broadly these are less expensive than Games Workshop paints?
They are, but they're also smaller.
Okay, that's
so
true.
So it's probably comparable.
Right. But if you're on a little bit of a budget, or also just if you're just like, I don't need that much of a color, I'm dabbling, then you got some options there.
Yep. We got some RPG stuff. We got BattleTech Alpha Strike.
A lot of people have been waiting on that.
I'm not 100% clear on what Alpha Strike is. It seems to be another box set.
Yes.
But I don't...
Yeah, like, is it a starter set per se?
No. People were very excited about it.
Yeah.
So if you're into BattleTech, Alpha Strike.
Yeah, look it up online and maybe you can tell us what it is when you come by.
We got the Homeworld RPG for a... this is a computer game from, like, the mid-90s, maybe?
Yeah, It was one of those big... Was it, like...
So you had like a big home. You had a big mothership, and you kept building like smaller ships that you sent out to defend your home world. You were like on a colony ship or something. This is an RPG based on that world.
Okay,
so it's like space exploration, I think.
What do they call those games 4X.
Sure.
Out there,
I don't call them that, but sure.
I don't know what I'm talking about. Nope. It's like explore, expand, extinguish your enemies. Something like I don't know. It's a kind of role-playing game. Yeah, and obviously an exsanguinate the unbelievers.
Excoriate. Extemporate. It's about public speaking.
Expectorate.
Expectorate. It's about spitting and public speaking. 4X. 6X. 6X games included spitting and public speaking. As a sort of like... Not a generation ship, but that kind of thing. It's like, I think it's like, I think that sort of like space colonization thing is an interesting premise. I don't know how the what the actual game is like, but I have a huge fondness for that RPG, for that video game.
To briefly pause, yes. I've looked up 4X games.
Yep.
4X is a subgenre of strategy-based computer and board games. The little preview told me what I needed to know more than the full click. It stands for explore, expand, exploit, and exterminate.
Oh, geez.
Good lessons to teach to people.
Speaking of
I believe Civilization is one of the famous 4X games.
Speaking of extermination, we got Cyborg,
what's that?
The newest, that is from the Morkborg games.
Oh, yeah.
So Morkborg is a, heavy metal influence game.
Yes.
It's a fantasy game is the baseline.
Right, think dark fantasy. Think if you took a heavy metal album cover of some demon spewing blood from its mouth, and a warrior with its sword stuck in the demon and entrails coming out. That's what Morkborg
If your friend who smokes a lot of weed and listens to Metallica made a role-playing game, this is the game they would make.
You got to upgrade past Metallica is too much old man rock now.
Right.
It's got to be Mastodon, which is itself out of date.
Oh, okay.
But it's got to be something.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Your friend who smokes a lot of weed. No, come on. All your friends smoke a lot of weed. They listen to Metallica and Judas Priest and the golden age of metal.
Sure, that's quite possible.
Anyway, Cyborg, it's an open license, and so they've made a bunch as a pirate Borg. It's coming up.
I've been looking into these recently. This is a quick aside. Maybe I'll even talk about this a little bit during our, topics portion. The game designer, John Wick, no relation to the dude in the movies.
No.
Has been doing the a challenge that you and I, Randy, have dabbled with, but I don't think either of us did all of this all the way. Make 31 role-playing game characters in 31 days.
I actually did, but I cheated a little bit because I made them all ahead of time and then kind of...
That's all right. We'll allow it. This is just... the idea would be this week Dungeons & Dragons, next week Call of Cthulhu, next week some indie game.
Yep.
Anyway, and he does little videos on it. And the kind of neat thing he does in his, and why what I would recommend looking them up online, is because, or on YouTube, is because he kind of gives you a little summary of the game for 5 or 10 minutes first, and then he takes 5 or 10 minutes to just talk about what fun character he made. It's all very watchable. It's not dry and stuffy. He's kind of animated and standing up and talking to you directly to you, and not sitting at a desk and being a dusty old man. Anyway, he talked about Morkborg, and I was now I kind of really get it. It is basically heavy metal fantasy.
Yep.
And one of the spinoffs, we got the sci-fi
Cyborg,
one.
So it's just cyberpunk.
Yeah, yep. And from what I've read about them, you can play them either, you don't have to play it full metal. You probably can play somewhere between that and normal cyberpunk
game. Why wouldn't you?
But I believe this is going to be weird cyborg robots, and they probably have axes, and they probably are part of a machine cult or something like that.
Yeah.
Instead of being this is not your hard sci-fi.
No.
As it turns out. What else we get?
But we also got the Blade Runner RPG.
Oh, that's pretty big.
This is the core rules, and we have a starter box. And basically in this, you play a Blade Runner unit.
Yep.
So it's different versions of cops. There's a profiler and a...
Oh, okay.
It's an interesting idea to turn it into an RPG.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically out there hunting down robots.
I believe you probably have an option to be a replicant.
You do not.
What?
You do not. You have to be a Blade Runner. You're a Blade Runner unit.
You could be a replicant hunting replicants.
No,
that's messed up.
Only Deckard can be that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was looking through it. Again, I've only skimmed it. It's a beautiful book, by the way. I think it's Free League Publishing. It's the guys who do Vason and The One Ring and...
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Those guys have... Those guys have really good production values.
But,
And I'm sure, Blade Runner is weird because it's these are some pretty serious sci-fi movies,
Yeah.
They're all moody and stuff, but they're also steeped in noir and mystery and stuff like that. But it's usually mystery with a sort of moral center to kind of wrestle with, dark moral stuff. So, again, fitting perfectly in with the noir genre.
Yeah.
That, I think, is a pretty good fit for a role-playing game. I'd be curious. I really want to see some of the adventures that they have and see what they're like.
Right.
Does it come with an adventure? Do you have
The starter box does, I'm sure.
Okay.
So, we got a couple of board games. There's one called Tiletum, maybe? Tiletum. That is a dice-based resource management game. It looks super fun.
Hmm.
I know it's one that's getting really good reviews on BGG. I haven't looked too much into it yet, but it's on my list to check out. We got the Ted Lasso party game, which is surprisingly fun. I played that. If you have any fondness for Ted Lasso, it does a good job of getting across. You're basically, your job is to inspire all the other players.
Yeah.
And it is a, it's a fun cooperative party game.
Okay.
I've played it with some friends, and it's surprisingly fun.
That sounds pretty cool.
You never know with licensed games, but that one's fun. King of Monster Island, which is a co-op version of King of Tokyo. You are all monsters trying to dominate an island. I don't know how the co-op exactly works.
I like King of Monsters. I've played a few times. It's a fun game, but you're always fighting each other.
This is a co-op version, and there's a volcano in the middle of it.
All right. Well, I'm not down with a monster team-up. That sounds good.
Castle Panic 2nd Edition, another co-op game. This is locally produced, Austin-based company. This is their new edition of this.
In the earlier days of co-op games, when there was, like, Pandemic and maybe one or two others, not a whole lot, this one came out, and it was, like, a kind of... I feel like slightly more family-friendly version of a co-op game. And it's a lot of fun. You have, like, essentially little standees of, like, castle walls that you put in the center. And concentric rings going outward. And the creatures, or randomized creatures, will appear on each turn. And they kind of, like, start marching forward down, like, almost like the old Space Invaders video game, getting closer and closer. If they hit one of the walls, they take out the whole wall. If all the walls go, you lose.
Yep.
And there's fun, and there's neat things, because you'll have, like... a warrior who can just like fight up close, knights who can ride out and go farther and get the guys in the next
archers
round.
Archers that
can
do the out.
And then you trade cards with people to like get extra hits in. You roll boulders that take down all the monsters in a certain area of the map, but will also knock out a wall. And every once in a while, you can repair a wall.
Yeah.
But it's like all of those games, there's a lot of down-to-the-wire stuff. It is a fun game. I missed the new version that came out.
Yeah, new version
cool.
came out.
It's a good family game.
We got a game called Animals of Baker Street, which appears to be animals in Sherlock Holmes.
Okay.
Looks super fun.
I'm a fan.
It's from ILO, the same guys who do King of Monster Island and Tokyo Kid.
Perlock Holmes?
Perlock Holmes, possibly.
Yeah. Pawlock Holmes, lots of possibilities.
A Space Mountain game from Ravensburger, the Disney license, the ones who do Villainous and all that.
Oh, it's like actual Space Mountain from Disney?
Yep. Orconomics, where you compete to be the most successful business orc.
Definitely, this sounds like a great idea.
A party game called Not That Movie, where I don't know exactly the deal, but it's another big sort of party game where your friends are trying to guess at movies.
I like movie stuff.
They look like fun. And then... just because I have to mention, the G.I. Joe Deck Builder has a second expansion called Cold Snap. That's all Arctic themed.
That's cool.
Yes. No Quinn that I know of, unfortunately.
And
but there will be.
He was original to the comic, so I guess I can understand why they might not have made him.
There'll be Snow Vipers.
Yep.
Possibly Snow Job.
Snow Job and the various other Arctic heroes.
Maybe Alpine.
Names I can't remember. Alpine should absolutely be in there.
Yeah. Frostbite.
Yep.
I'll just keep naming things that might be G.I. Joes. Those are all G.I. Joes.
These are all correct. Yes. These are all correct.
Blizzard.
And Icy Clutch.
Icy Clutch. You get Icy Clutch, you got to go see the doctor.
Icy Clutch, Icy Duke.
Icy Duke.
Icy Scarlet.
Icy Gung-Ho.
And of course, Icy Gung-Ho.
Actually, if there were just like winter variants of all those, that'd be cool. They all have parkas and stuff.
Honestly,
like,
yeah. You know, on Star Trek Prodigy, one of their CG animated thing, a few weeks ago they had that one where they're with O'Kana in it, Randy.
Yeah.
And you saw, like, Janeway and her crew, and they had, like, sort of, like, snowy versions of their kind of regular outfits. They had that classic color schemes, but, like, higher collars, and it looked thicker. And I was like, oh, those are cool. It's just the kind of thing that's easier to do in CG than have the wardrobe department come up with a bunch of stuff for, like, one freaking episode.
Winter gear and desert gear, I don't know if there's much, and forest gear, there's not much cool. Like, Star Wars did this best. Like, the Han Solo outfits.
Hoth set the template in that.
But also, like, all the Endor costumes were cool.
Yeah, they knew what was going on, and G.I. Joe responded to that. Although, it is actually, like they rarely accept, maybe in the comics and the cartoons at times, showed, like, Snake Eyes wouldn't normally be wearing a coat. He was just always in his regular Snake Eyes thing.
You know, seriously, like making new costumes is always, like, Avengers Endgame did this really well. They had the suits they used to travel through time.
Yeah, yeah.
Those were all cool, too.
They were. It is like, you know, like arguably sometimes a bit of a cash grab if you're doing, you know, you're going to be doing merchandising of these things.
And you are.
And yet, the little kid in me is always like, oh, cool, a new look. Yeah. That is, and you know, it's no, like everybody has different skins in video games now. Right. So that clearly this concept lives on.
We don't all wear the same clothes every day. Why would our heroes?
That's true. I'm wearing a hoodie right now.
That's true. Dave's in his winter gear.
Yes, that's right. This is Texas Arctic gear.
Texas Arctic winter, Dave. And on that note, we're going to pause for a second, and then we're going to come back and talk about comics for the week. So before we talk about comics for the week, I forgot, we have one little bit of news, right as we're starting the podcast.
Yep.
They dropped a new trailer for Across the Spider-Verse, which is the second trailer. Across the Spider-Verse. That is the second Spider-Man Spider-Verse movie coming out from Sony.
What was the first one called?
Into the Spider-Verse.
Into the Spider-Verse, yeah.
That was Into. Now we're going Across.
Okay.
The third one will be called Down the Spider-Verse.
do we know what the actual premise is? Because this is kind of a dazzle you with some images and a few like kind of neat scenes and
so here's the thing. When they made Into the Spider-Verse, those trailers were mood trailers.
Yeah.
They didn't reveal it until they got to the movie. Like they showed the scene with Spider-Ham and all that. Like we knew who was in it.
Yeah.
But like
nobody knew what the premise was.
It, like we didn't really know the premise. And I hope they stick to that.
Yeah, that's kinda cool. So this one starts with Miles Morales' mom talking to him, and she's got kind of this gravity to her tone. She's coming out to talk to him like on their rooftop, okay, where he's hanging out. And she's kind of talking seriously, and Rainey, I think your surmise might be right. Is like she maybe knows that
Sense I get that maybe that like she knows he's Spider-Man.
It's almost she knows he's going to do some stuff, and she's kind of talking about
Spider-Verse music there. I was trying to look it up on IMDb,
and they're like, "Why don't we just open an autoplay some stuff?" Yeah. But yeah, she's talking like, hey, we need to have a serious talk about your safety, and you need to know we'll always be here for you, and stuff like that. Anyway, but it sort of sets this tone, and then there's a bunch of rapid fire images,
right.
And of course you see like Spider Gwen in there, and Randy, who all else is in this? I mean, I feel like the big thing is, even though he's kind of only towards the end, is Spider-Man 2099. Yes. That's going to be big thing.
The big reveal of this trailer is we see Issa Rae's Spider-Woman.
Oh, right,
and
right.
She looks great.
She does look super cool.
And she's in the costume.
Who's Issa Rae?
Issa Rae is a comedian. You would know her. She's done a show on HBO.
Okay.
She's done a bunch of stuff.
So she's just voicing?
Yeah, she's voicing. She's great.
And is this a existing character that we know?
Spider-Woman? It's clearly
a new iteration of Spider-Woman.
I mean, it clearly is Jessica Drew. She's playing Jessica Drew.
Oh, I didn't know. Was that clear?
Yeah.
Why is that clear?
It's in the IMDb listings.
Oh, that's not that clear.
And she's wearing Jessica Drew's costume. She's wearing the cool jacket costume.
The current one? Okay.
It's an updated version of it, but it is based on that costume.
Okay.
And she's on a motorcycle, and she looks cool as hell.
She does look cool.
But so we see her, and then also, yes, Spider-Man 2099, voiced by Oscar Isaac.
Oscar Isaac,
yes. And he voiced him at the end of the previous one.
Randy, you were guessing that he may in some way be a threat.
There's something about it that makes it things like maybe he may be doing, like, trying to do good things for bad, or bad things for good reasons or something.
Right. He kind of has, he looks really big, by the way, just compared to Miles.
Yeah.
And he's got, kind of looks like he's got a big upper body strength. He looks like, instead of being like a teenager, he looks like he's a 20-something.
Yeah.
They're presenting him a little bit menacingly.
And Miles has aged a little bit. We can tell that he's, I mean, that's part of the thing his mom's saying is like, I thought it was a really interesting, this is the thing I think Lord Miller do well, where she's saying, like, you know, you've always been this little boy to me, and now you're a man, and I need you to protect that little boy. Like, maybe she's telling him to protect himself, because he's an adult now, and he has to protect himself. And I thought that was, it was a really good monologue, I thought.
Right.
Because his mom didn't get a lot of work, like, she got a little bit of
it was mostly about father-son stuff.
Her dad, yeah, his dad and his
Or at least that dominated.
And so it's good to see her getting a little bit of time. But yeah, it's We're still getting mostly mood and like a bit, but what we're seeing, I love. I'm excited about.
There was a lot of those kind of wild eye popping visuals of like going through time, sort of that Doctor Who style, pulled through time tunnels and stuff like that. That looked like just like bonkers. Like my mind was still trying to process it. It looked very cool.
Yep.
There's a cute scene of he and Gwen. I think seen from behind, and they are upside down, like must be hanging on a stoop. But it's like they're just having this casual conversation, and she kind of does the lean against him and bump him in that sort of affectionate way. Like,
I actually think that might be a nod to some of the Spider-Man comics. I think I've seen that move.
Oh, interesting.
That's a nod.
But yeah, it was just one of those little details that looked really good.
Yeah.
Anyway, looks pretty cool. When's that coming out?
That's coming out in June, I believe.
Okay, that's not too far off.
Yeah, for
all things considered. Dune 2 won't be out until, say, November of next year, so that's,
it's after,
all things considered.
It's after Ant-Man. It's after Quantumania.
Okay.
Which I believe is February.
Ants first, then Spider-Man.
Ants, then spiders. then sandworms.
Then sandworms. That's the classic order.
Yes.
And we're adhering to it.
Rock, paper, scissors. That's
Well, in the Marvel universe, yeah.
Yes. So we're gonna talk about comics for the week of December 14th, 2022, and it's not as big as last week. Last week was a flood of comics.
Yep.
But this week does have one of the big releases for the year that a lot of people have been looking forward to. And that comic is, of course, Harley Quinn Uncovered, a collection of Harley's... No, it's not that. I mean, that does come out this week, and it's really cool.
Yeah.
But the comic that people are looking forward to is Batman Spawn.
Yes.
30 years later, there's a rematch. And it is it's not referencing... Like, as far as I can tell, this is not referencing the other Batman Spawns.
Right. Which you might have thought that they would do, since... Famously, Batman's batarang to Spawn's face carried over into Spawn's comic.
Yeah.
But that was more like just a fun thing.
It would have been kind of fun to reference it,
I think. It would have been kind of fun.
But they're doing a new thing. Batman and Spawn don't know who each other are. They're being pitted against each other by the Court of Owls.
Yep. And there's a link between them that is sort of revealed, and that, and as well as Court of Owls connections.
Yes.
To both characters.
So it's written by McFarlane. It's pencils by Capullo. So this is the Spawn team that's was on Spawn for a long, long time.
Yep. And Capullo, of course, he went over to DC to work with Scott Snyder on a whole bunch of stuff.
Notably Batman.
Batman, and then also like Dark Knight's Metal and Death Metal and all that stuff.
Yep.
So Randy, and Randy, I haven't read this yet, but you said his art was pretty good on this.
His art is solid, yeah. I mean, it looks really good. If you're a Batman fan or a Spawn fan, this is going to look like the Batman and Spawn that you probably like.
When I read, I skimmed an interview with McFarlane talking about it, and he said that, his approach, you reminded me, Randy, that Jeff Loeb does this too.
Yeah.
When he's working with an artist, is to ask him some of the stuff he wants to draw.
Yeah.
So this is, a good showcase. If you like that Spawn style of art and or Greg Capullo's style of art, which is now on Batman and a bunch of other stuff.
Right.
Then that is another big reason to check it out. And there's also a ton of different covers.
Oh, there's a bunch of covers.
They're all really cool. They're all super dope and metal. So pick up 1 to 3 of them.
Why doesn't someone make a Spawn board, Dave? They need to make a Spawn...
I guess they should make a Supergirl game.
Board, yes.
Yeah, and then basically by default it's a Spawn.
It would be like Cyberforce Spawn. It would be all the 90s Image stuff.
That's true.
They should make that game, actually.
They should go ahead and do it.
We also have Tom King's newest one, Danger Street.
Yep.
This is his ode to fourth tier characters. It's like
it's I believe an homage to one of those ones that's like not like first issue comics or something, but one of those
DC's comics Cavalcade or something like
that. Yeah, one of the weird comics of the 60s that might have not the ones that had Dial H for Hero, but that kind of thing.
Yeah, because it is Warlord, McCall, the alien Starman,
Metamorpho.
I believe. A sort of new kind of Newsboy Legion type kids.
Yep.
Lady Cop.
Yes, Lady Cop is the name of a character. We're not describing her. That's her name. Or her superhero name.
And also,
did you mention the Creeper?
The Creeper. And also Dr. Fate seems to be involved somehow, or at least his helmet.
And this is Black Label, so it might be set a little outside of continuity. We don't really know.
It looks like sort of big, wacky superhero adventure. Or not wacky, but
in that kind of wild, the wilder side, and kind of the stuff that would almost be considered campier side of DC.
Yeah.
But anybody who's read any of Tom King's stuff knows that he doesn't really do campy per se. He likes some of that stuff, I think, but he kind of lenses it through his sort of serious way. He's going to have, I think they said in the solicit for it that it was essentially going to be a crime comic,
yeah,
or have these crime comic elements,
yeah,
but be wrapped around all of these kind of Z-list characters.
I will say the selling point for me, as with so many of Tom King's latest projects, is the artwork. I don't know who this artist is.
Yeah.
I don't remember the name.
Something Fornes? Jorge Fornes?
But it
which maybe you say
me,
Fornes?
It reminds me of Michael Lark and Steve Lieber.
It's really incredibly
beautiful.
Good artwork.
Yeah, it's really, really
super good.
DC also has Dark Crisis Big Bang, which is Mark Waid and artist Dan Jurgens taking the Flash on a tour of the new multiverse that's coming out of Dark Crisis.
Is this the finale to Dark Crisis?
No, this is a side story.
Okay.
Basically, Barry Allen going up against the Anti-Monitor, and in the so doing, he goes
a clash across worlds.
He goes through all these different worlds. We see little bits and pieces of them, and at the end,
clash of two worlds,
flash of
a bazillion
flash
worlds.
Of like 60 worlds.
Yeah,
but at the end, there is this 2-page spread of text of Earths. Mark Waid researched this, so basically, all the Earths we know about are enumerated on the back 2 pages of this comic. And for someone like me who loves multiverse stuff,
yep,
that alone was the reason to have this. Like, it's got everything from like Batman and Darkest Night to DC vs. Vampires to Batman 66.
To the Elseworlds where Batman and other heroes are pirates.
Yep, those are all mentioned here. Tom Strong, the Zoo Crew.
Randy, you mentioned, I just lost my train of thought. There was something in there that was an interesting format, or maybe it was just, I remember they've got like Amalgam Comics.
Yeah, Amalgam's noted.
Milestone.
Earth 387, no divergences in history other than every inhabitant is a werewolf.
Yes. Oh, I know what I was going to say. It's that there's a few Earths where they figured which weird stuff could fit together.
Yeah.
Like, you'll be like, oh, right, yeah. So an obvious one is that Batman 89 shares the same universe as Superman 78. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
Yeah. And there's a few other fun ones where I'm like, oh, I wouldn't have just immediately thought those could share the same Earth, but it makes sense.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. This is definitely a goofy sort of tour through the DC universe. If you don't like multiverse stuff, you'll hate it.
Yep.
But if, like me, you have a huge fondness for multiverse world stuff, this was a really fun sort of guidebook to the state of the DC universe as it will stand after Dark Crisis ends, which I thought was kind of cool. We got the Harley Quinn Uncovered, which... Mm-hmm.
It's a cover. It's just a collection of covers, but a lot of them are... I mean, aside from the fact that she's had a lot of great main covers, this also includes a lot of rare variants that, sometimes maybe even stuff we didn't even get.
Oh, yeah, retailer variants, like for one retail store got them.
Right, only or if you got like 100 or whatever comics, you could get this. So there's lots of cute pin-up-y Harley Quinn and fun concept Harley Quinn, and her hyenas make a number of appearances.
Yes, they do.
I'm sure the Joker's in there somewhere. Probably Poison Ivy is probably more, I would hope, more often in there. But there's some super good art in this. If you like Harley's design and want to see a bunch of like a great artistic showcase of a lot of different looks of hers, this is Harley Quinn Uncovered is one you should just go ahead and get.
Okay, I'm moving on to Marvel. We got, I think this is the first one ever, Monica Rambeau Photon #1.
I bet she had a miniseries.
I think she's had a one shot. I don't think she's ever had a miniseries.
No, maybe not. She was in Next Wave, but that wasn't focused
right,
on her.
Right.
And arguably wasn't exactly a serious depiction of her.
No.
Now, Randy, I think we should hit the backstory real quick on this. People know from the MCU, I would bet, primarily now. They know Monica Rambeau as, bestie of...
She is the kid of the bestie of Captain
the
Marvel.
The grown kid of the bestie of Carol Danvers. That's right.
She showed up as a kid in the movie, and then, of course, thanks to the vagaries of immortal Captain Marvel, or at least... slow aging.
Yeah.
And then in WandaVision, she showed up as an adult and an agent of S.W.O.R.D.
Right. And she got powers in WandaVision.
She got powers. Yep.
That's probably the main thing that they're taking. But they've kept her, or comic book origin, in this. This is a very, very much honors, I think, her history. And that's what I was going to say is, Randy, you and I happened to get in on ground zero, the ground floor of her character way back in the 80s when she was introduced in a Spider-Man annual.
Yep. Which I never read that annual, actually.
Oh, have you not read that?
I read it when she showed... Because right after Roger Stern, who wrote that annual, I have read it now.
Brought her into Avengers.
He brought her into Avengers, and she was like... First of all, one of the few black Avengers. Definitely the first black woman, right? That was an Avenger?
I think so.
And very quickly rose to the ranks to be the leader of the Avengers.
Yeah, a couple years passed or whatever, and she became the leader.
And, of course, nowadays, people would be like, this is so woke.
Yeah.
Then, nobody thought anything of it.
Yeah, we were like, oh, that's a cool new character. Oh, I like the writing.
Yep.
And I'm sure people would be like, oh, but at least they weren't forcing it. I'm like, they were doing it just as
much as they did,
they were now as they were then. The writing was there. Roger Stern did a great job.
I plugged into this character. I really liked her. I liked her sort of as
she was a New Orleans harbor cop, which was unusually specific.
Yeah. Who got energy powers, and then
because of some crazy Roxxon thing, you know, their evil,
Exxon,
their evil, oil companies guys who were always doing creepy experiments and stuff.
But she was like the outsider she was a point of view character because she was not an Avenger. She wasn't in the superhero world, was all new to her. But she had this vast power that made her more powerful than any of the Avengers.
Right. She could basically transform into like sort of light, move super fast, like fly at light speed.
Be invisible,
change the wavelengths of light around her. Yep. And she could like pew pew blast stuff too.
Anyway,
she had a cool costume.
She one of the things that Walt Simonson did, which I will never forgive him for, despite the legend that he is, he came on after Roger Stern and Mark Gruenwald, to the people who I loved in comics, had a fight. Gruenwald was the editor, and Stern left the book, and Walt Simonson came on and did the first like Fall of the Avengers thing.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that happened is Monica Rambeau, when we're trying to stop Marina from Alpha Flight being turned into she was Leviathan.
Okay,
she was turned into Leviathan, and trying to stop her, she expended all her energy and lost her powers.
Oh,
this is like after Dr. Druid had like mind controlled her. And they really like tanked that character.
Mm.
And then she kind of floated around for a while, and she was Captain Marvel.
Sometimes it does happen, and I don't think that like Walt Simonson was being racist or anything like that.
Clearly a racist.
But like sometimes you'll get a writer on who's just like, I don't know what to do with this new character.
Yeah, he didn't have any interest in doing
Captain
Marvel. I love
the classic Avengers or the ones that I grew up with or whatever. And they'll just kind of find a hasty way to write the person out, and they don't always do it exactly respectfully.
No.
And so that's what happened, apparently.
And then the next time she really prominently showed up again, because she was floating around here and there.
Sure.
But, like, I think Busick used her, and they kept trying to give her new code names.
Oh, right.
Because Captain Marvel got retaken by... And Carol Danvers is a great Captain Marvel, don't get me wrong. But to me... Monica Rambeau is always Captain Marvel.
Right.
And they tried
the original Captain Marvel, the dude Captain Marvel, had died.
Yep.
And so she took the name.
Yeah. So now she goes by the name Photon, which I believe they've sort of settled on her. She was in Next Wave, which I hate. and this is a new sort of number one to try to, like, take all these disparate versions of the character and make an ongoing series with her, which I think they're doing a pretty good job of, like, respecting her history, touching on all the elements of it.
I like that
her mom and dad are in there.
I was very happy with it. I like that she's kind of very clearly known in the superhero community.
Yep.
Spider-Man knows her.
Yep.
Who else did we see early on? Doctor Strange and Wong know her. Like, they kind of make sure you understand she's got her bona fides.
Yeah.
And there is a mystery plot involving this weird giant guy who's like
he's all bendy and stuff.
He's all bendy, almost like Reed Richards, but kind of in a more freaky way.
Yeah.
So there's subplots going on, and definitely some family backstory stuff. But as I'm flipping through it, I'm reminded I really like the art in this.
Yeah.
I thought the family scenes and stuff were also really good. There is a funny scene that Randy, I feel like, is practically calling people like you and me out, because there's an older lady on the street who sees her, and she's like, Captain Marvel! And she's like, oh, it's Photon now, and the lady's like, very sweet, she's like, oh, I've been following your adventures forever, I know all about your Avengers stuff, and I've got the press clippings, and you'll always be Captain Marvel to me. And I was like, oh, it's us.
Yep, Dave and I are old women.
We're old women. That's all right. It was clearly done with love, and I can allow for it.
Yeah.
But I was pretty happy with this. I felt like it respected the different eras and managed to kind of, like, talk through them really quickly without making it feel like I was getting some giant-ass info dump, which I hate.
Right. And then the other big Marvel first issue this week is Invincible Iron Man, as Jerry Duggan along with artist Juan Frigeri, who I don't know the artist.
This is a good Marvel week for me because I actually quite like that.
I thought this was a really good first issue of Iron Man. The first issue I've really loved in a long time.
I mean, I could probably go back, I'm going to say 15 to possibly 20 years since I had an Iron Man version or comic that I was kind of really into.
Well,
even like Warren Ellis's Extremis stuff, which did rewrite the book on Iron Man and set up the movie in a lot of ways. Man, I don't know that there's really been any version that I really liked, but this has the potential to be that version. It's just the first issue.
Yeah.
But what I had read about it when I was making the sign, and that also made me worried about it a little bit, they're like, we're gonna have Iron Man hit rock bottom. And they're like, if you thought that when he had fallen into alcoholism that was it, he actually got through that pretty quick, this is going to be serious. And they were equating it with Daredevil Born Again, which is, like, I think the best Daredevil story of all time. So I was worried about it. Jerry Duggan is a guy who's primarily known as, like, the best, like, the longest running Deadpool writer.
But he also has done a fair amount of, like, X-Men.
I think I mostly avoided his stuff.
Yeah, I think it's like,
not intentionally.
So I did too, Dave, because he came in with Brian Posehn.
Yeah.
And I've always thought of him more as basically a celebrity writer.
Yeah.
Who did Deadpool.
Right.
But I started following, so he wrote that Savage Avengers run that I adored.
Okay, yeah.
And that, from there, I started following some of his other stuff and realized, oh, I kind of like Jerry Duggan's writing. Not always, but in general, I like his stuff. And this is definitely on the high line of his stuff. And yeah, he's doing a, Tony Stark is laid low by a mysterious adversary who's sort of, he's lost his money, which I think is another, we've always talked about Batman and Iron Man are kind of problematic these days. So taking them from billionaires to guys who have to struggle with money a little bit again is a good idea.
Yep.
He has one Iron Man suit left. He talks in the opening about the, you know, Avengers Mansion and Stark Tower and his Malibu mansion, all the stuff he used to have. He's like, yeah, I don't live there anymore.
This one has been, you know, this one was destroyed by bad guys. This one's been turned into an Avengers theme hotel.
Yeah.
And
so now he is like, he's in like a brownstone in New York, and he's like, yeah, I'm not going to tell you where it is. And it's also, he's like writing his autobiography, which I thought was a good narrative device.
They kind of, very quickly, it's not like a true recap of his history, but they hit a few highlights just to kind of give you a sense that this guy has been around and has had highs and lows and a sense of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they hit you with some stuff as his things start to fall apart in the end.
Yeah.
There's, like, an assault attack on him where somebody else gets killed, like a bystander gets killed. And they didn't, like, this is the kind of thing, I feel like if Mark Miller had done this, like, especially as he was 10 or 15 years ago, it would have been, like, 3 dozen people died.
Yeah.
Instead, it's, like, a single person, but it's still, he feels the weight of it.
Yeah. Also, I was going to say, Dave, I do want to say that Iron Man has had some good runs the past, like, Kurt Busiek's run is good.
Right, but that's the 1990s.
Matt Fraction's run is good. That's 2000s.
Busiek was?
Yeah, Busiek's 2000s.
Okay. I guess I'm thinking of his Avengers.
Is good. There was another recent run. Oh, Tom Taylor's Superior Iron Man, although a different thing was kind of good.
Maybe for you.
That said, this feels like the classic Iron Man that I've been wanting.
Yeah.
This got me in a way that Iron Man hasn't since, like, Michelinie wrote it.
Well, you know, what I noticed, Randy, I don't know if you noticed this too, was that, you know, we know how influenced everything has been by Robert Downey's amazing portrayal from the movies, but sometimes the way they do that in the comics almost takes it and kind of turns it a little cartoonish.
Yeah.
Like, not everybody, you can't always in writing without kind of capture the charisma of Robert Downey Jr.,
exactly,
the actor.
Yes.
And so instead, sometimes he just comes across as this grinning, snarky guy you want to punch in the face.
Yeah. This is the most likable Tony has been in a long time.
And it reminded me a little bit more of, like, his incarnation in the 80s without feeling dated.
Yeah.
But the way he was, like, a little bit more serious. He's got a sardonic sense of humor or whatever.
Yeah.
But he's not, like, snarky.
Yeah.
And we'll see how that continues to come along. I also don't think it'll alienate people who came up on the Robert Downey one.
Right.
But for me, and I think this is going to go for a lot of fans, old school fans. Check this out. It feels like it's tapping into something there.
It's a really
and I feel like Duggan's writing is just pretty good.
It is.
And also, by the way, I don't know if it's a double-sized issue or there's just a lot to it, but I feel like you're getting a lot of content in that one somehow, as if there was like an extra 10 or 20 pages.
I agree. It's a really solid
issue. And not one of those ones where you're like, when is this going to end?
Yeah.
All right, what else we got?
Image has a couple number ones this week. One is Nightclub, the newest thing from Mark Miller, with artists Juan and Ramirez.
This has a pretty... Mark Miller always does these interesting hooks. They're arguably kind of very Hollywood-y.
Yes.
But they are pretty good at what they do, and this one has the hook of... Randy, you've read it, so you can describe it.
But so it's basically a YouTuber who wants to be famous... has an accident and becomes a vampire.
Right.
And then
he has an accident. Was he just attacked by a vampire?
No, his accident, he's a dumbass who's trying to parkour his bike off a roof. He breaks his neck and he's in the hospital.
How does he become a vampire?
A vampire comes into his hospital room and turns him into a vampire.
Ah, okay.
And he's like, I'm recruiting vampires for some kind of secret war. We don't actually get that in the first issue.
Right.
Because this kid actually, after this mentor takes him and teaches him how to control rats and how to turn into mist. The very next day, he goes back to his buddies and is like, we're going to be rich. Like, he's going to decide to use his vampire powers to become a YouTube star.
Right. And specifically, he wants, like... Isn't he, like, using, like, a sort of superhero motif?
There's no indication in the first issue. I guess that's the pitch
cover
document.
Where he's wearing a mask, and I guess what I read in the solicit made it sound like that. Sort of like a... you know, it's funny, the solicit made it sound like more like he's like, oh, I've got powers, this is what I've always dreamed about, I'm going to be a superhero.
It does not look like superhero.
But he's a little bit more like trying to exploit it.
This looks like more YouTuber extreme kind of
thing. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, it's a pretty clever spin on, you know, very traditional vampire type stories. So, you know, credit where due. Mark Miller's not my guy exactly, but that sounds fun.
It's a fun first issue. And then we've got from Ice Cream Man, the sort of horror anthology that's been a big hit.
Huge hit. Like a crazy big hit for Image. Randy, when was the last time we had an anthology comic that could be called a hit?
I mean, Silver Coin is also an anthology, and it's really good. But it
doesn't do as well as Ice Cream Man.
So W. Maxwell Prince, the writer of that, had an older book called Art Brute that I think they're now reprinting.
Yep, that was my understanding. They called him like the solicit at least said he's almost like this like art cop or something like that.
It's a very Grant Morrison-y type thing. Basically, there's a the Mona Lisa is winking at people. People are freaking out, and they call in this guy from an insane asylum to figure out what happened to the art. So it is like it's like weird art crime Crime Stoppers,
right? But like clearly, there's an element of surrealness to it. But yeah, if you are one of those people who is liking what he's doing in Ice Cream Man, or I think if like this concept or that Grant Morrison kind
of fan of Morrison
Doom
stuff,
Patrol weirdness, appeals to you.
If you like Doom Patrol or Invisibles, this is going to be right up your alley.
Yeah, I'm flipping through it and I can absolutely see that. That's nice artwork.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
And then we've got Boom's A Vicious Circle, which is a big, like, it's the Black Label format. It's the big, giant...
even though this is not Black Label. It's that format, of like, a.k.a. magazine size, with a spine on it and a cardstock cover, some very nice artwork inside.
The art is by Lee Bermejo, and the writing is by Mattson Tomlin, who is writing on the Batman sequel. I think may have written
That is like the movie, The Batman, that was like the big hit.
Did he write for The Batman, or was it just the sequel he's working on?
I think it said that he's working on the sequel. I think in this list that they would have mentioned if he had written the main movie.
So basically, the pitch on this, I'm going to read from the back of it. Sean Thacker is a trained assassin from the future who seeks revenge on the only other man with his affliction. Each life they take forces them to travel between vastly different past and future eras. That's sort of what shows the first issue takes place, and it's basically an African-American man. He's got a boy who's maybe like 10 years old and a wife, and he's in this sort of, he's in this segregation era where he's like, desegregation is going to happen in November 14th of this year, and so he knows some stuff. He's also got a man tied in his basement who is the other time traveler, and things happen, and he winds up jumping into the future, and these two are sort of tied together, and one of them is trying to prevent the future, and one of them is trying to make it happen.
Okay.
And that is what it's about. It has got very different art. Like, the opening is this very black and white photoreal art style. Then it jumps into more of a colorful, cyberpunky future. And then we see glimpses of other timelines.
It's all pretty good-looking art.
It's really pretty.
People will look up, like, if you don't know Lee Bermejo, that's Bermejo, I think.
Yep.
Check him out online. His art looks like the Batman movie does.
Yep.
Painted art of, like, kind of gritty, realistic-looking costumes and characters. So sounds like he's he's always going to bring something to the table.
Boom has a graphic novel this week, Grimm. This is another one of their hits. This was it's about a woman who dies and discovers that she's been recruited as a reaper, someone who ferries souls to their final destination. but she doesn't know who killed her, and so she's trying to solve the mystery of who killed her while also doing her job as a, like, Reaper escorting
That's
people.
That's right. I remember reading this and liking it pretty all right.
Yeah, I've read
that. Is she, like, looking into her own murder on her own time? You know, the equivalent of a cop who's chasing after a case that's kind of like they're not supposed to?
I believe
to.
So, yes. artist by Flaviano. Very pretty.
Okay.
And then I think one of the big things we were all excited for this week is Friday, Book 2. This is Ed Brubaker and Marcos Martin's kind of Encyclopedia Brown.
Slash kinda. The Hardy Boys or whatever. Yeah, it's like it took those characters and imagined a, you know how, like, people should, if you know Ed Brubaker's crime comics at all, you know that they're kind of adult.
Yep.
And, like, in the best ways, like, they actually are maturely written, but there's going to be sex and violence and moral duplicity and moral grayness. And so he imagined a if you want to think, an Encyclopedia Brown and almost like a Nancy Drew type who worked together on some cases when they were teenagers, had like an awkward first sexual encounter maybe, or like...
And then sort of broke up.
Sort of broke up, have gone to their separate ways for college, and suddenly he like calls her back, and I think he's like...
They're
like,
in their 20s now,
I think. They're in their 20s, and they've put some time behind it. And they're still friendly, but there's, like, an awkwardness between them.
Yeah.
And I think he was... Because the last volume came out, like, a year ago or whatever.
Yep.
And I think he called her back and he's like, hey, there's a new case, or there's a case and I need you on it, or whatever. And there's a question of whether they can do this again. So it's got tropes and elements of, like, that YA mystery genre. And then it's got tropes and elements of what you would expect from Ed Brubaker.
Yeah.
And beautiful art.
And
like,
also, there's a supernatural thing. There's like a cult or something. I don't remember
that's
this
right.
at all. So there's
I'd kind of forgotten
that
it.
Is more... Because I just read the second volume of this, and it's really good. We all really like this. The only downside to it is you have to wait
the
a year for
between.
Every chapter.
Yeah.
But it is super good.
That is a great... It's a great hook. And, so... Is it Marcos Martin?
It is Marcos Martin, yeah.
He's, like, Brubaker almost always seems to work with sort of not photorealist, but people who have that kind of an Alex Toth sort of dark realism style of artwork. And Marcos Martin is unusual for him. He's a little bit more cartoony.
Yeah.
Like, he's still very, like, very detailed artwork, but it almost reminds me of, like, those detailed European graphic albums.
Yeah.
With slightly more cartoony characters, maybe.
Yeah, I get that.
Anyway, it's a cool look. It's nice to see that art paired with Brubaker's writing. It's a little, it makes it feel like a slightly unusual project for him.
Yeah. And then I just want to mention that Superman, Son of Kal-El, Tom Taylor's Superman book comes to an end this week. And that they'll be picking up in the new year with the new number one.
Yep.
But that's a great book and always continues to be a great book.
It's a cool ending that had what I thought was a clever payoff to something I did not even know was being set up.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't. Maybe they just realized that they could make this work. But there is a very neat thing that happens in it that deals with something that I was like, oh, I had no idea that could ever be, you know, this sort of item could ever be used that way. But it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a smart idea. I always like when they show how, like, the heroes can be pretty smart and stuff. It's been a good, heartwarming series, too. Randy, I think you noticed this one has a great thing because the Kent farm got blown up a year ago.
Early on in the run.
And in this issue, the Justice League are helping put it back up while, like, Batman is handling security. And he's like, yeah, this is going to have, like, this force field trigger. You know, like, nobody is ever going to mess with you again. The Flash is, like, you know, hammering all that stuff at super speed. And you get that vibe of what it's like to, like, say, be Clark's parents and have these guys as your backup. And like, that sort of sense of family that it brings. It's really good.
Yeah. All right. That'll take comics for the week. And we're going to take a break and come back and talk about Willow. All right, so we are going to talk about Disney Plus's Willow series, which has 3 episodes out.
Yep.
We are going to be offering spoilers, so if you've not seen it and you're worried about spoilers, don't listen.
Yep.
It's all we're talking about this week, so you can just call the podcast off.
It is not a heavily spoiler intense show.
No.
But there's, like, you know, the end of the first episode has a kind of a notable thing that happens. And
I spoiled that for myself by looking at IMDb while I was watching.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How could you spoil that? It's just the appearance of a person.
It's the name of a character.
Oh, I see what you did. Yeah, that's the. Yeah. I think I was thinking there was two things.
Nope.
There was one thing.
The person is credited under the name, and I'm like, oh, yes. Well, I guess that's who that is.
That is a big reveal. Yeah. That is a big reveal. Yes, that's funny. Okay, so let's do a quick trip back in time to, I think, 86, 88, somewhere around in there. 88, maybe.
Before we had Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah. The 80s had done some fantasy movies, but they tended to be lower budget. The bigger budget ones were things like Excalibur, Krull.
Yeah, Krull.
And not too many others. There was, I guess, a few like Beastmaster and stuff.
Yep, yep.
And
Your Hunter from the Future.
That did exist.
It existed.
And probably the biggest budget of them all was probably Willow. It was like the pricier one at the time because it was produced by George Lucas.
And it had Ron Howard direct.
And Ron Howard directed it.
Wasn't the first thing he directed or anything, was it?
No, he had directed Splash first. Actually, he did, maybe even Night Shift.
Oh, I think
he might have directed
Night Shift first. Yeah, yeah.
For all I know, there was something before that, but I think that was the first breakout.
Yeah, so Willow was 1988.
Yep.
And now I'm looking to see like when Ron Howard... Anyway...
Willow as a property, I feel, is pretty derivative.
Yes.
You're going to see a lot of, the original had a very Lord of the Rings-like thing where a hobbit-like person is called upon to step outside of his village and perform this task, which seems like it might be able to be something you could get done with quick at first, but then becomes a big clash between good and evil. And there's prophecies. There's a little baby called, named Alora Dannon that washes up on his step, and he's like a new father. That's actually kind of unique. It's like, a lot of times your action hero don't have a family. He had a wife and kids.
True.
He ends up meeting notably with Val Kilmer, great, and maybe the most memorable thing about the movie as Mad Mardigan.
A roguish swordsman.
Truly a Han Solo type, and I think probably the best part of the movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But there's also some fun, like, wisecracking little brownie fairy types that he meets along the way.
Kevin Pollak plays one of those. He will be reprising his role.
There's Willow's frequently attempting to use the magic, and either some early CG, or it was stop-motion animation with CG-assisted movement, I think, so that it had a kind of a smoother movement than stop-motion generally had at those times.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it was a big clash with evil, and they win, and stuff like that.
Also,
and Willow proves himself to be a sorcerer.
But remember, the important thing here, Joanne Whalley Kilmer, Kilmer's wife at the time, was playing one of the villains, right?
Right, who has a... When he accidentally falls in love with her because of a love potion...
Oh, I forgot about that.
It softens her hard heart, and she ends up helping in the end against the really scary or bad guys. You kind of get the impression that she was, like... a villain who, like, had that family obligation to kind of live up to, like, what her parents told her to do and all that. But all she actually needed was someone who didn't treat her like somebody who just had to live up to a family expectations. Well,
like Mad Mardigan, was she kind of a sellsword? Or am I misremembering?
I think she was. She definitely was, like, a... She was, like, leading the army and stuff like that.
So
the bad guy army.
Okay.
But, yeah, they end up getting together... And along the way, one or two NPCs die. I remember there is a character in this named Eric, spelled kind of A-I-R-K, I think.
Yeah.
And that is one of the guy who died. He was
And
I realized, they named a kid.
They named a character after him. Okay.
Or that is to say that somebody named, like, their kid after
him. Mad Mardigan and Joanne Whalley Kilmer's character. Yep. Name is, where is she in here?
Sorsha. Yeah.
They are now, like, the king and queen of this area.
Yep. Only some things have passed. We know that, like, Val Kilmer was, like, for health reasons, was not able to really reprise his role in this.
Right.
But the way they kind of worked that into the story in the new thing is that he is off... he went off adventuring and disappeared.
He disappeared, yeah.
And he was, like, on a quest kind of
Which
thing.
Which felt very Mad Mardigan.
But I think they were otherwise doing good. It wasn't quite like Han and Leia, who, like... kind of, like, had, like, clearly this trials and tribulations. Like, they were doing all right. Where the original Willow movie was about, like, this little guy going out into a big world and finding it, this actually begins almost on the opposite end, where you're seeing, like, the royal family and stuff like that. And Willow will, light spoiler here, not show until the end of the first episode.
Yep.
He is the sort of first quest. Is like, they're like, you need to go, we need to get Willow in on this.
And honestly, having seen all three episodes... I still don't feel like Willow is the legacy character here.
Right.
The story is about the younger characters who are the progeny of these heroes. So it's like the daughter is Kit Tantalos.
Okay.
And her brother, Eric.
Right. Let's talk about them real quick.
They are the prince and princess of this kingdom, basically.
Right. And she, what does she want to do?
She wants to be a warrior.
She's about to be betrothed and stuff, and she wants to be a warrior.
She wants to be a warrior. She's training with her best friend, Jade Claymore, played by Aaron Kellerman, who you might remember as Flag Smasher or Enfys Nest from Star Wars.
From Solo, yeah.
So she's definitely made, she's Marvel and Star Wars and now into a fantasy.
Yep.
She's going to hit up Star Trek and she'll be all good.
And then the brother, the prince, is kind of like a, what is it? He's a Don Juan,
yes,
kind of guy.
Yes.
Who's more interested in, like, kind of sleeping around and making out. Although they kind of, don't they make out that he kind of genuinely does fall for these people?
So he has genuinely fallen, maybe whether or not he always does, he has genuinely fallen for this sort of baker's assistant named Dove.
Right.
Played by Ellie
Is it
Bamber.
Because he doesn't know her name? Is it? Is that,
I don't, he's kind of. Yeah.
I think they make the. He makes that joke like she's. He's like. He's telling his sister. He's like, I'm in love with her. And at some point, I think she's like, do you know her name?
What's
and
her
he's
name?
Like, I call
her
Dove.
Dove.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yes, like they're neither of them are like. You know, exactly, bold warriors in Mad Mardigan's tradition, or, like, clearly,
well,
fit up for a rulership.
Kit is very well-trained. Like,
that's
she
true.
Is, she is training with Jade Claymore as like, and she's being trained by the Commander Ballantyne, and she clearly has a skill with a sword.
That's true.
But
that's
she's
true.
Not supposed to. It's kind of very Pixar's Brave. She's
right.
a warrior, but she's not supposed to be.
Right. What they want her to do is unite some kingdoms by getting married.
They're getting married to Graydon Hastur, played by Tony Revolori, who you might remember as Flash from the Spider-Man movies.
Right. That is to say, the most recent Spider-Man movies, where Flash was not like a jock, but like a kind of bullying nerd.
Yeah.
That Flash.
Tony Revolori is hilarious. He's one of my favorite parts about it, because he is so... He is not... When they wind up having to go on the adventure, he's like, I want to stay home and eat fancy foods. Like,
he is, like, smarmy, but, like, when they give him some scenes where he can actually be a little bit more nuanced...
he's genuinely good.
He does it. He does a good job of it, and I like that they had a character like that. Most of their characters seem to be kind of... in the tradition of the kind of tropes of the original, if they're a scoundrel, they're a scoundrel with a heart of gold.
Yes.
Or if they're, like, a layabout or a Don Juan, they're a layabout or a Don Juan with a heart of gold.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that sort of somewhat family-friendly fantasy.
You could even call it cheesy to some extent. I think it would
sure.
not be fair to say there's some cheesy elements to it.
Right. Even the way the dialogue is written is meant to be, I think, a little bit like tongue-in-cheek, a little snarky,
yeah.
And invite that. Now, Randy, I'm trying to remember. I've seen two episodes. You've
yeah.
seen three.
Yeah.
What is it that really... What prompts them? Why do they need to go...
There's the crone...
Oh, right.
And she seems to have kidnapped...
This is going to be our big bad.
She
if you
sends
want to,
her
like,
four, like, monster men, which they were all cool, by the way.
They were. They look... These guys almost are, like, real heavy metal.
Yeah.
They got, like, chain whips and teleportation and
they
stuff.
They come in and they kidnap Eric.
Yes. Eric is...
He's the prince.
He's the prince.
He's Mad Mardigan's son.
Right, right.
And so Sorsha basically said... She's going to send her commander out to get him...
Do they even know where he is?
They sort of have a track somehow. I think they know where he is. I think.
Right. I mean, but, like, I was just like, oh, does everybody know where... What's the bad lady's name?
The Crone,
the Crone.
I think.
Does everybody know, like, where her kingdom is? Like, we're just like,
know,
let's go
I think
to Crone Land?
Roughly where she is, yes.
Okay. But I think she's like, you're going to need some help, even though it's like... And a lot of people go, it's like, it's the man-at-arms, and it's the princess, and it's the
yep.
princess's trainer,
yep.
and a number of other people, and it's the princess's betrothed,
yep.
a.k.a. Flash Thompson.
Who doesn't want to go, but his dad's like, this is your princess, you're going.
Yeah, it is pretty funny to see a guy who doesn't even want to go on the quest. You know, everybody in Lord of the Rings is all like, I will go, I will do what needs to be done. And he's like... I'd like not to.
But among the people who go, because Eric was kidnapped, is Dove, the chef's assistant, who insists that she's going with them.
Right.
And she starts to reveal that she is like has some abilities that she didn't even know she had
right.
in terms of keeping up with them. And when she meets Willow, he recognizes her as Alora Dannon, the baby
yeah.
from the first one. She's like a chosen one type.
Right.
She's supposed to be able to wield magic.
Right, and that they had essentially kind of hidden her away as a very normal person,
yep.
so that she was just like a baker's assistant at the castle.
It's a shit deal for Alora Dannon, by the way, to go from being a chosen one to a baker's assistant.
I mean, you know, like, this is one of those things, it's like, fame is a double-edged sword. Like, it's probably better to not be known as the... the chosen one, because also people are going to try and kill you.
That is true.
That's the whole reason they did it.
You're probably going to get good food and nice bedding if you're being, you know, so you might.
I like to imagine she probably snuck in some meals in the kitchen.
I guess.
But yes, this was an interesting thing because, like, I didn't guess it, and I thought it was kind of fun. I was like, oh, wow, everybody's going on this quest. Even the cook lady who seems nice, but I don't. I was like, I don't know what she's really doing here.
I didn't guess
and
it
then
all.
In the end, they're like, oh, you're the chosen one.
I didn't guess it at all, except. This is the dumb thing I did.
Looking at IMDb.
I was like, that girl is familiar. Where do I know her from? And I go, and I see that she's credited as Laura Dern, and I'm like, well, shit. And then I knew. And so that surprise was ruined for me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also in the third episode, there's an actress who shows up. She's from Ted Lasso.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also from Game of Thrones. And I'm like, wait a minute. That sounds and looks like, no. And she's playing kind of a bit part.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is she doing here? And I feel like they must have been shooting this in England or something.
Can you say who she is from Game of Thrones?
I don't want to say it.
Okay.
If people who have watched both of those probably know who it is. There's only so many people who are in Game of Thrones and Ted Lasso.
Right. I haven't seen Ted Lasso, so I don't know the answer to this.
But when I saw her, I was like, she's a great character. Unfortunately, she doesn't last long.
Is it Lena Headey?
It's not Lena Headey.
Okay. She's the only... she's English, though, right?
She is English.
That was all I had to guess. Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, we also didn't mention too much the guy, Thraxus Borman, who's, like, in the dungeons.
Oh.
And it's still, like, Matt Mardigan's old buddy that his wife has had imprisoned. And she lets him go to help with them. And he's, like, the most competent swordsman amongst them.
Right. But he's also, like, a cynical sellsword and a kind of, like, a... He's like a skeevy, roguish type.
Yeah,
he's got this really long, dark, curly hair, super intense eyes. He looks like Rasputin.
Yeah, yeah.
And like a very intense presence, but he's kind of like he's more snarky than he is actually like this intense guy. Like he kind of looks like.
Yeah.
But he's a fun presence and gives it some of its Mad Mardigan fun vibes.
Yeah. This is lightweight. It's very D&D-ish. It's not great.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still
making up my mind on it, but I was enjoying the ride pretty well. It didn't quite capture the movie, which I think because the movie had like so many tropes in it.
Yeah.
That like it felt it was comfortable in its own way.
Yeah.
This is a TV series that is kind of slowly getting around to those things. But it is like, some of the dialogue might be a little tropey, but it's like, it actually is like, I don't particularly know where it's going from one moment to the other, and I guess that's to its credit.
I had more fun with this than I expected to. That said, it is ranked fourth in all the other, because like, this year we had Rings of Power, House of the Dragon, and Wheel of Time. No, this is third, because I actually like it better than House of the Dragon.
Oh, interesting. Some people really like that House of the Dragon, they're like, it's A-list.
Some people really like that Game of Thrones stuff. I think I've gone off it.
I will have to see if I can get pulled back in, but yeah, I have to admit, I fell off it, and I'm not exactly missing it.
I want some fun in my fantasy, and this one, like all the other ones, has fun in it.
Yeah, I actually liked Wheel of Time quite a bit.
Yeah.
It had some fun in it, too, but overall took itself more seriously than this. Yeah. This one, of them, and you know, Rings of Power has its lighter moments.
Yeah.
This is the lightest of them,
though. It is, yes, it is the lightest.
And so you should go into it knowing that. I think Willow fans should have a good time. I'm going to quick talk about the ugly, elephant in the room, which is I heard it got review bombed on, like, IMDb.
Really?
Because there is just a hint of a queer relationship.
Oh my god, really? Be a little problem with that.
And you know how like small it is overall.
Yes, it is. It's like one moment.
Right. And maybe it's like something more will come up, but it's just one of those things where it's like, because a gay character exists, people are like, ugh.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, if that is who you are, I don't want you.
Nope.
No, they shouldn't. Yeah, don't be the audience. Go hate yourself. Die unhappy.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know that will particularly affect it, but people know that review bombing stuff happens.
Yeah.
It's just obnoxious.
It is.
But, like, I think this is a show to have some fun with, and honestly, I really like that character who is the queer character.
Yeah, I do too.
I think she's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do too.
You know what I want to see some more of those? Like, I want to see some more of those bad guys, those arch bad guys.
These guys are cool.
They're good enforcers. If you kind of remember, like, Thanos' crew, they've got a little something in common with those guys. You're like, oh, when these guys show up, you better watch yourself.
Yeah. Well, that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.